The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
China's businesses and the broader economy came under increasing pressure in August. Factory activity expanded at a slower pace, while the services sector slumped into contraction.
Home prices in the key 20 metro markets surged 19.1% in the year through June. That's the biggest annual price gain ever. The largest year-over-year gains were seen in Phoenix, San Diego, and Seattle.
Bitcoin soars past $50,000 yet again, flirting with a prolonged rally. This as El Salvador is poised to start accepting Bitcoin as legal tender next week.
The jobs report is out. August non-farm payrolls increase a minuscule 235,000. 235,000. You heard me right. It's a big disappointment. And if all you can think about is substantial further progress, most likely this gives the Fed ground cover to potentially not announce the taper as aggressively, but only time will tell.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, this week, the S&P 500 closed up 0.58%, the NASDAQ Composite closed up 1.55%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down almost 0.25%, showing the preferred investment continues to be large cap and tech specifically. The drivers this week were largely economic, as the most important topic to investors took shape around that Jackson Hole Symposium meeting last Friday, when Powell suggested he wanted to see more jobs data before committing to a reduction in asset purchases. Now, that proved to be prudent, as with increases to COVID infections in August at the national level, job creation fell well below consensus. Non-farm payrolls increased by 235,000 versus a consensus of 750,000, which will give the Fed room to delay a formal tapering announcement past the September 22nd meeting. But here's the twist. The average hourly earnings were up 4.3% year over year in August. And given the doves at the Fed might postpone a taper, that leaves more room for policy error and inflation fears to be supported for a while longer. We see this in the 10-year Treasury that climbed 3 basis points to 1.32% Friday on weak jobs growth instead of falling. But I don't think we're going to see interest rates climb all that sharply in the coming weeks if the trends continue in the other economic indicators announced this week, which, given COVID infections continue to increase and haven't peaked yet, it stands to reason those trends will continue for the time being. Starting off on Tuesday, the Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index decreased to 113.8 in August from a revised lower reading of 125.1 in July, which showed similar data to the University of Michigan's report earlier, that COVID Delta variant infections going up, rising food and gas prices were eroding consumer confidence. The same day, the Chicago PMI, that's the Chicago Regional Manufacturing Information, fell to 66.8 in August from 73.4. Still elevated, you know, still very high, still running at full steam, but again, decelerated. And the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index increased 19.1% year-over-year in June, up from May, also a concern for consumers. China's August manufacturing fell in August to 50.1, basically flat growth, and services fell into contraction territory at 47.5, China being the proxy for global growth. U.S. ISM manufacturing was up slightly in August to 59.9 from 59.5 in July, which shows most manufacturers continue to struggle to meet demand due to shortage of basic materials, transportation difficulties with goods stuck on ships and ports going offline earlier, worker absence and difficulty finding labor replacements. Factory orders were up 0.4% in July, following a 1.5% increase in June, so some deceleration there as well. And again, just showing that there's some issues still with supply chain bottlenecks, and when COVID Delta started to curb some demand. U.S. ISM Services PMI Purchasing Managers Index decreased to 61.7 in August from a record high of 64.1 in July. So despite decelerating, it's still ticking along at a very good pace. Initial claims decreased 14,000 down to 340,000. That's the lowest we've seen this number since March 14th of 2020, and shows things continue to improve there. Again, if there's no replacement of workers, why are you going to lay them off? You're not going to be able to find them replacement. Besides COVID, most of the concerns over the market continue to reside around the looming fiscal cliff, which is the ending of the federal eviction moratorium and enhanced unemployment benefits. There's issues with infrastructure bills passing. There's still some infighting. We've got two bills to work with, and one party wants, or one section of the party wants them both, voted on at the same time. Well, that was passed where, there'll be a vote, I think, at end of September. Again, inflation is an issue and a concern for consumers, as we've seen that confidence drop here. And a stock market that hasn't seen a pullback of significance in over 200 days. So these are some issues that are looming, but the earnings continue to be strong, evidenced by Broadcom's well-received report on Friday, which also influenced many of the other chips. And the Fed continues to keep interest rates low, both on the short and the long end of the yield curve for the time being. That's it for this week's wrap-up report, where the events were solely focused around the economic reports around jobs, global growth, with China as its proxy decelerating here, and the effects of COVID on consumers here in the U.S., combined with high prices for everything.
Daniel Fajel at Emerge AI Research has spoken before the UN, the World Bank, Interpol, and other major organizations about the risks and trajectory of AI, particularly when it comes to its potential impact on critical sectors of the economy and society at large. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week.
As more and more of our experiences get sucked into a virtual world, as AI is able to be trained on more and more of our preferences at a very deep level, trained as to what's keeping our attention, what's losing our attention, what's getting us excited, what's getting us depressed. When AI is getting a lot of rich feedback in this virtual ecosystem that we're about to enter, we will be able to spin up programmatically generated experiences of all kinds. Now, where this gets spooky for some people is that over the course of 20 or 30 years here, it will be the case that these programmatically generated experiences will be better than their physical equivalents. And I think that what this looks like is a huge preponderance of the first world living entirely in virtually augmented ecosystems in something completely different than the modern day human experience.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
We welcome back Financial Sense Wealth Management's own technician and senior portfolio manager, Frank Barbera. Frank, before we start, I just want to say what a pleasure it has been these past many months to work together. You helped me get my CMT license many years ago, 14. And just having you on our staff has brought a tactical portfolio that our aggressive clients have been asking for, more trading support to Chris Paplava and Ryan Preece, and just another set of eyes on the market to make judgment calls on our investment committee. So it's just been, like I said, a real pleasure.
Well, Ryan, I have to say the pleasure has been all mine. It's been a joy working with you and your brother Chris and Jim and Ryan Preece. It's just been wonderful too. So I'm very happy to be part of the Financial Sense team, and certainly it's one of those times where there's a lot going on, and you haven't had much need for tactical management lately with the stock market going up, hitting new high after new high, day after day. But it's like everything else in life, it's a pendulum, and change is inevitable. And when that comes, I think we'll be well situated to capitalize on any increase in volatility. So I love doing what I do, and it's great to be working with you as well.
Well, Frank, you brought up a really important topic that I guess we'll just hit right away. You know, we've been in a bull market since, things turned around in March of last year, 2020. We know that all bull markets eventually die at some point. Looking out as far as you can see on the charts, the developments, maybe sprinkling in some fundamental analysis, what is the biggest risk you think this bull market faces in the months and maybe years to come?
Well, I think, okay, on a longer term basis, I would definitely say inflation is the biggest risk this bull market faces. And maybe even to put a finer point on it, a collapse in confidence regarding the bull market in terms of the management of inflation. I date back my career, I hate to date myself so much, but I started with an interest in markets when I was very young. So I've been watching markets from quite some time. And I actually started working in the industry in the mid-1980s. So I can kind of remember the Paul Volcker era. I remember 15% three-month CDs at what was the time Home Savings of America. My dad got me up one Saturday morning, and we had to queue up on a line that was about almost a mile long at Home Savings here in the South Bay in Los Angeles because everybody was going out to get CDs. And ironically enough, that was the time to be buying stocks, not CDs. But the point is, inflation for many years has been very quiet and had been falling until recently. And I think back then, the confidence that Paul Volcker instilled in the Fed as having to do what it was, he was able to throw the economy into a recession, tighten real interest rates over and above the level of actual inflation. And basically, he strangled the economy into a recession and broke the back of inflation in the process. That was true central banking. And over time, that has been sort of watered down. And what we've kind of evolved into now is almost, I think the markets are coming to a point now where they're asking the question, are they still the same central bankers they used to be? We have seen quantitative easing start earlier in the 2000 decade. It was started under the promise that it would be emergency use and then stopped. We saw QE1, QE2, QE3. But as everything else with power, it seems to now have be threatening the point where it's being abused. And we now have permanent quantitative easing. Quantitative easing as a normal state of affairs, even with GDP growth right now that is 6%, albeit what looks like trailing off towards 2.5% very sharply. But you have to wonder, as inflation, headline inflation is surging towards 5% on CPI, and some of these other geometrically chain-weighted mean reverting measures of inflation that the Fed has conjured up, the deflators, et cetera, pushing even their own mandate at 2%. When is the Fed really going to look at inflation as a serious mandate? That's not what we just saw coming out of Jackson Hole with Jerome Powell. Inflation was backlisted, and other priorities have been moved to a higher place. I think what's really brewing here is a stagflationary environment, Ryan. We're seeing economic data roll over. I don't think there's any question about that. The polling on things like purchasing managers are coming down pretty hard. Consumer confidence is coming down pretty hard. And so we're probably looking at GDP that's contracting from 6%. Morgan Stanley this morning cut their third quarter estimate to 2.6 from something north of 6. And at the same time, as Chris Poplava has been quite on the spot about, it looks like inflation is going to remain very sticky. Owner's equivalent rent, it looks like it's poised to continue moving sharply higher for the next few months. So the question is, Fed's not going to taper now. At what point will they? Or how far will this be delayed? And then we have to wait until the QE is tapered all the way before they start raising interest rates. I think the markets may be heading next for a moment where there's a little bit of crisis of confidence in the Fed and whether they can really manage this or whether they've put themselves in a god-awful box. And right now, that latter outcome is what seems to be the case.
Yeah, the cry from most of the Fed presidents over the past couple of weeks have been to taper sooner than later. Of course, we had Jackson Hole just last week where Powell basically said, I want to see a couple more jobs reports before we really consider it. Maybe that things get held off maybe a couple more months. The market is probably going to run with that kind of information. So I'm addicted to the QE.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's exactly where we're going. It's weak data on jobs will mean that taper is deferred. It looks like they're really trying to push it back into December or early next year. And I think the risk in that is that the market will run with it and we will get some kind of blow off parabolic type move in the stock market. And this would be a parabolic on top of a parabolic. So you're creating a situation which at its core is getting more and more unwieldy. Whereas, right now it's still within the realm where if they finessed it, you could probably get a correction and then maybe some kind of consolidation. I think the situation is starting to move into that eighth, ninth inning where something's going to have to give. But in the short term, I agree with you. I think they're trying to push off the taper, defer it, and the market will probably try any way it can to run higher, especially with all the liquidity that's in the system.
Which is tremendous. And we still haven't seen the fiscal stimulus once or if it gets approved, moves through, and what that does to the economy. But Frank, we touched on, I think, your biggest fears, inflation. And then, will the Fed be behind the eight ball? Will they start to become more aggressive? The more aggressive they are and the sharper that rates go, that unsettles markets. What is the most important development you see in the financial markets overall right this minute?
Again, in terms of the large macro view, it's pretty clear that we're moving towards a stagflationary environment. I would also add that I think the geopolitical events of the last few weeks around Afghanistan are creating a more destabilized political sphere worldwide. And to some degree it's sort of impacting the U.S. the way the U.S. is being seen in terms of projecting power around the world with its adversaries and such, that could add more instability over the next decade or so. And that's another part of this pot which is brewing. A lot of these things can really reflect themselves in the value of the dollar. So when you look at the dollar, it's the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. And to some degree, the dollar's fortunes will move with sentiment toward in that direction. And right now, I look at the dollar and I think, while tightening and tapering should be bullish for the dollar, to me, the dollar is beginning to look like a currency that wants to roll over and start moving down. I think we're going to have to watch that very closely. Always, it's what this is about is risk management and not predicting anything, but the wave structure of the dollar looks like it may have peaked an ABC countertrend rally over the last few weeks. That's Elliott jargon to just suggest that maybe we've had a nice rally in the dollar and the dollar may be turning down pretty soon. There are some key levels to watch, but that would be shocking if that were to develop. And I think that would offer other markets like commodities and maybe gold, especially gold, a big opportunity, a hole in the line to run through.
Well, since you brought up commodities, let's take a look there. Dave Nikoski and I, last week, we were looking at the dollar. We saw a failed breakout, started to move down, hasn't quite looked like it's rolled over to destroy that upward trend just yet, but is in the short term, it's definitely been moving down. Obviously, if the dollar weakens here, that means some really bullish things for commodities. We've seen oil hit above 70 again. What's your thoughts on commodities in general? What are the ones you're focusing on? Maybe making some tactical moves in now. What were your thoughts there?
I will answer that. Let me chime in just for a second on the dollar. The dollar's roughly 92.30 right now, and the key support is 91.78.
So very close.
Yeah, recently we tried to break out above 93.70 on August 20th, and that breakout failed. Mm-hmm. If we broke below 91.70, that'd be the first red flag. I'd also point out that the August 20th high in the dollar was a higher high, but momentum really peaked back in mid-June. And so we saw some negative divergence. These are just red flags that say, hey, maybe the dollar's coming off of some kind of a high. When I look at the commodity markets, what I see is a lot of distribution taking place. And I think for the most part, the commodity markets are tied to the China credit impulse. And the China credit impulse, you know, the Chinese economy, which manufactures a lot of the goods and services around the world, that is starting to contract. That impulse is coming down. And so you can look across the commodity sector and you see things like platinum and palladium, which are down very substantially. You've had big bear markets. Those are sort of pro-cyclical commodities. They have been weak. Copper has also been weakening. And the chart on copper to me looks like it's poised to potentially roll over and move down. Mm-hmm. And I say that even with mindful of the fact that the stockpiles in copper are pretty low. You look at feeder cattle, cocoa, lumber, the grains, soybeans, unleaded gasoline, for example. We saw the lead contract just make a new high a few days ago, but none of the back months were able to do that. Gasoline went to new highs, not confirmed by crude oil. Crude oil is still very strong, sitting around 70.2 right now, but that's coming up against a declining 50-day average. I suspect $72 on crude is going to be pretty strong resistance. And while I think the energy complex will stay strong for a while, I think overall the fact that China's growth rate is weakening and that the global economy, if anything, seems to be slowing right now, this is going to keep commodity prices to some degree in check. Now, the one thing I think that's really happening where we have the big surprise might be in the precious metals. And the precious metals have been a bit of a mystery all year because quite honestly, a couple of months ago, if you looked at the headline inflation data, one piece of news after the next was all, here comes roaring inflation. And yet silver and gold were sitting there completely quiet. And I think my supposition at the moment is that the reason the precious metals did not move during the summer when inflation was running up high was because there was a certain amount of confidence there that inflation might be transitory, that it might be a fleeting phenomenon. And so to that extent, the money was moving into other sort of pro-cyclical, pro-growth commodity areas. I think right now we're on the verge of a different framework, and that framework may be the monetary authorities don't have control over what's really going on. They're printing way too much money, way too long, and making a policy mistake. And so I think the next leg, what we're starting to see are very oversold readings in the precious metals and in the precious metals stocks. And so that has me thinking that we may be getting very close to an important bottom in that group, and they may just decouple from everything else. This is early, it's preliminary, but I can tell you, for example, I've tracked the gold stocks for 40 years, and the McClellan Summation Index for the gold stock group closed last night at minus 27. It's very rare when that gets below zero. I can track that back almost 50 years on a daily basis. And if you go back and you look at it, readings below zero in the zero to minus 500-600 range, which we could be at within a week or two, those readings have attended important bottoms. And I also keep a 100-day ARMS index. Again, I can track this back about 50 years almost. That's at 1.35 as of last night. And we've seen readings there above 1.25 in the past that have been the threshold for important lows. So we have seen GDX down 33% in what has been an over 1 year bear market. And I believe that right now it's unloved. The sentiment is very negative. And we have to watch, because the next thing that could spark a fire in the precious metals could really be sort of a collapse in confidence in general, maybe in institutions, and the ability of institutions to continue to manage the situation and keep things corralled. I think there's a concern brewing that the situation could become unwieldy, and that there's way too much leverage in the system, and the money may decide to vote into gold as a result. So that's speculation, pure speculation on my part. But I am seeing technical readings that are fairly rare, and that's enough for me to say, okay, let's just keep an eye on this. If it starts to reverse into a positive trend, we can move with it and jump on board. Certainly, there's a lot of great deep value in some of the precious metal stocks.
Well, Frank, you mentioned quite a bit there. One thing I wanted to unpack was you were talking about Chinese impulse credit and, you know, global slowing of manufacturing PMIs coming down. Chris Poplava focused on that actually on his Monday investment video at our website. So listeners, please feel free to check that out because he implied that just to summarize there, that the Chinese have started reducing their reserve rate requirements. And at the onset, that's not what really stimulates things. There's quite a bit of a lag as they continue to reduce the reserve requirement. So Chris did some great correlation studies there. Definitely take a look at that. Now, Frank, let's focus in on interest rates and treasuries, because you brought that up as well. Treasuries have been trading sideways here. Is this a consolidation and ongoing move higher that started in the spring, or do you think inflationary fears will finally break free? You know, it definitely feels like cognitive dissonance. You know, we're talking about some of those confidence in institutions that you mentioned. Interest rates have been moving down while we're seeing crazy inflation. It's like cognitive dissonance when you think about it, with market rates remaining this low while we continue to see prices rising literally on everything. I just read an article that showed housing prices are up 25 to 29% this year for Seattle, Phoenix, and San Diego in June from a year ago. And I'm looking to sell a motorcycle that it's held its value for 2 years. I just shudder to consider upgrading anything in my house due to labor and appliance prices. But, you know, I have to, because my refrigerator lights thinks that it's a disco time. Every time I open up the door for food and drink, light just keeps blinking and blinking. So I get a seizure every time I open up my fridge. I have to replace it.
Oh, that's so funny. Now, we're living in a very strange time, because the U.S. economy is extremely supply constrained right now. I went into Staples yesterday. A printer on our house went on the fritz the other day, and I asked them, I said, do you guys fix printers? And they say, oh, no, basically everything is disposable. So I went looking, and they normally have a gazillion printers in Staples. And I talked to the guy, and he said, basically, we don't have any. We're really out of everything. So he said, it's all in the ports. It's on ships. Yeah. It haven't been unloaded. So on the one hand, I've heard this from friends looking to buy tires for their car. They can't find tires. So there are a lot of basic goods out there that are not present or that are in very short supply. And so, you know, I think, but prices for a lot of other things like food, meat, poultry, they're all moving up sharply. So I believe that the higher prices are beginning to pinch consumer spending, and they're hurting consumer confidence, and the economy is starting to weaken.
I'd agree with that 100%.
That's the first point. And the same thing is, I think that the supply chain effects, while they may be transitory and part of the inflation may be transitory, I think they're also masking some monetary inflation, which is maybe bleeding into the economy from the Fed. And so I think we might be seeing some of the, some of this unlimited QE finally really beginning to create a more strategic turn in inflation. I don't know. But to me, something is going on that's not normal. It's a stagflationary environment. I think it's going to last longer than people expect. And if the central bank is not moving to intercept, if they're not moving to kind of get a clamp on this pretty soon, I think you're going to start to see confidence fray And that fraying confidence in not only the way the economy is being managed, but the general larger geopolitical situation, I think is going to start pushing money into precious metals. People are going to say, you know what? I'm not sure I trust what's going on. And I want to own something that is not simultaneously someone else's liability, that is actually intrinsically solid money. And I think that's where the push to gold is going to come. So I'm definitely watching that. And I'm actually of the opinion right now that the metal, the physical metal, gold, is beginning to turn up ahead of the gold stocks. And at a lot of cycle lows, that's exactly what happens. You see gold make the bottom, turn up. To me, it looks like gold may have seen a spike low just recently and is now starting to turn up very quietly, even as the precious metal stocks are probably still a couple of days away from bottoming. But I think that complex is starting to turn. And that's very unusual right now in a contracting economy. But my best assessment is that that's probably a reflection of the changing strength of confidence, that what was very high confidence is now weakening, and people are starting to hedge their bets with a move towards gold. That's my wild thesis, but we'll see how that all plays out. Interest rates, Ryan, they've been in the tightest range in a long time. We're at 129 on the 10-year. The upper 20-day Bollinger Band is at 134. The lower 20-day band is at 124. So there's a 10 basis point spread on the 20-day Bollinger bands, which is basically a volatility compression. Mm-hmm. I have no idea which way rates are going to go, because I think the bond market is organically broken at its core. I don't think it's really manifesting real price discovery. Long-term interest rates should be much, much higher than they are right now if we had a true and free capital market. And I think this managed market has created huge distortions. And interest rates should be heading higher. But right now, I would not make that bet. To me, it looks like they could go the 2% or 1%. I really couldn't tell you. So I'm going to stand off on that and watch which way the market breaks. But, you know, in a different reality, high inflation like this in a long-term bond, the bond should be under a lot more pressure than what we've seen.
Yeah, you know, the program trading that goes on these days doesn't really care about, you know, what I'm going to have to pay for a refrigerator. It's just following the chart, and we have to follow the charts to know when they're going to break out and which direction. We don't know ahead of time.
Exactly right.
Yeah, so we'll just sit and wait and see what happens to interest rates. But we do see some action going on in the dollar, which could maybe lead the way. Frank, let's turn back to stocks. Let's focus here on the S&P 500, large cap, you know, a real charge to new highs here without a 5% dip in more than 200 days. I forget the specific number. That was a Bloomberg article 2 weeks ago. So I guess add another 10 days. It's just been relentless this year. What's your short-term view and intermediate-term view for large cap stocks here?
I get, you know, the answer to that is right now they're in an uptrend and you have to ride it. But because it's just a pure liquidity monster at this stage of the game. Mm. I can tell you, I've been watching the stock market for a very long time. And when you look back at various time spans, as a technician, I look at time as well as price, because the market has a pendulum-like nature. So the market moves overbought to oversold, overbought to oversold. I see things like the dollar-weighted calls to puts premium ratio, which has not seen an oversold reading now in the longest in 30 years. I have AD oscillators that have not checked in with oversold readings in historic lengths of time. So there are many aspects of the stock market right now which are pointing the way to say this market is way overdue for a correction. You can't argue with price. The price keeps moving up and pressuring its way higher. It's getting a little short-term overbought right now. So what I've been doing, the way I've been handling it, is I keep looking to play the rotation. What we've seen lately is that large cap growth has come on strong. And as that has come on, we've seen other good quality stocks, stocks, for example, in the staples, in the REITs, in other areas where they've been thrown out the window. And so usually when something is showing up on my oversold screens, I'll watch it. As soon as I start to see it stabilize after a period of time, we look for positive divergence and then an upturn in price. That's usually the signal to be, you know, to be getting in. So I've been really focusing on trying to play those and so far doing reasonably well at catching those rotational changes. But I think that's the safer way to play the stock market. Most people aren't doing that. Most people are putting the money in indexes, and that's been great. But that again has a time limit on it. At some point, I think the market is going to be okay. My gut is that it may have a correction of 4 or 5%. There's support on the S&P around 42.30, around the 50-day lower band, and then the 100-day average at around 4,300. So that range between 4,250 and 4,300 looks like a range of solid support if we did see, a 5% pullback on the S&P. But I think if we had that, we would still probably come up into higher highs into the end of the year. I think the big time to be concerned is as we get closer to December, January next year, that may be a point in time where the market is coming into at higher levels, maybe a more important top. But for right now, I'm trying to place money in positions where I know I can manage the risk with a close stop, and also where I can see reasonable appreciation. And so that's the key. It's a very challenging market. It doesn't look that way, but looks can be deceptive. And this one, I think, is deceptive on a grand scale.
Yeah, you know, Frank, I can recall this summer, there was a lot of discussion and calls for earnings peaking. And all throughout the earnings season, we saw estimates going up, not down, for the S&P's earnings. So it'll be interesting, like you said, between December and January, maybe what happens at that point. Will we continue to see, you know, year-over-year comparisons are going to be a lot harder to beat?
There's no question, Ryan. And last point on that note, I know we're going to wrap it up, but internally the market has been weakening. And so you've had a huge rotational correction within the market that has brought off a lot of the key technical indicators have come down off their highs. So all of that says it's late cycle, late cycle can last sometimes longer than you think, especially when you have like a blow off dynamic possible, which is what we're in right now. So it just means you have to be very, very vigilant and attentive. And thanks again for all the time today.
Oh, you bet, Frank. Is there anything that we did not cover that you felt our listeners should know about? We didn't focus too much on sector rotation. I have seen cyclicals turning up here. Is this just kind of a counter trend from this summer's weakness, or do we finally have a reversal there? What's your final thoughts there?
I'm really in the camp right now. I think the cyclicals are vulnerable to the potential for a slowing global economy and the contraction in the China credit impulse. So I think we're going to see a shift. The probably high cap growth will continue to lead over time, but I think there'll be interludes. I'm finding some decent value right now in some of the very conservative staple stocks, in things like Smucker's Jam, General Mills, Kellogg's, Mondelez, Constellation Brands, Conagra, Kraft. A lot of these stocks have been sold off very, very hard, and they look like they're approaching bottoms, at least trading bottoms. Some of the telecom stocks and selected REITs, some of the data center REITs, also the medical building, office building REITs. So I see pockets out there where I think, and a lot of these pockets pay very nice dividends, which is a key factor in my money management approach. I really want to try and, you know, offer people a combination of value and yield with good risk management. So I think there's opportunity out there, but you have to be selective and you really have to wait for pullbacks where they come. And if you look hard enough, they're there, but it takes a lot of active monitoring day to day to find those opportunities.
Yeah, like you said, you know, a lot of people hiding out in the indexes where they don't have to do that level of analysis. It's been quite difficult to stock pick if you're not hiding out in large cap and tech. But Frank, thanks for filling in for the guest expert and the technician this week. I really appreciated working together on this episode with you. So thanks, and look forward to the next time.
Thank you so much, Ryan. Have a great weekend.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on this week's edition of Smart Macro is Chris Poplav, our Chief Investment Officer at Financial Sense Wealth Management. Chris, last week we discussed the forecast for slowing economic growth heading into next year. If you wouldn't mind, give us an update on your outlook in light of this week's economic data.
Well, last week you and I discussed essentially kind of, you know, China's the growth engine of the world. So essentially, if you kind of want to figure out where the world is heading, just see where China's already been. And what we were seeing was that China was the first into the COVID downturn. They were the first out of it. And because of that, they were the first to also begin to slow down. You look at the Fed is discussing tapering. That was another topic we discussed last week. China is essentially already doing that. I mean, they saw a lot of deceleration in credit growth and other things that they did to kind of slow down growth, especially in fiscal spending. But while we talked about a peak in Chinese growth leading to a peak in global growth, what I want to touch on right now is, you know, really pointing out that we haven't seen an upturn yet in China's credit cycle to kind of give us, a sense of this slowdown that we're about to enter into when it might end. And, essentially, I think there's a little bit more deceleration that's to come before China really starts to accelerate their credit cycle meaningfully. And part of the reason I think that is just kind of looking previously at what we tend to see before China's credit cycle begins to tick up. And what I'm looking at is China's reserve requirement ratio and changes in that, as well as taking a look at Bloomberg's China credit impulse. So Bloomberg does a great job of looking at all the different types of financial lending in China and aggregating it into an overall index to measure their credit cycle. And what we see is that we typically see several cuts in China's reserve requirement ratio for their banks prior to the Bloomberg credit impulse for China turning up. We saw that in 2008, we saw that in 2011, and we saw that in 2015 as well as 2018. And what we've seen is just a minor cut recently to China's reserve requirement. I know a lot of people are thinking that's going to mark the bottom, that China's now leaning towards easing, but so far it's pretty early in that easing cycle, not enough to actually lead to a turn up in their credit cycle. And that's when you look at where we are right now, it's more akin to the early part of the, I would say, easing cycle for China before their credit cycle turns up. So I don't think what they've done so far is enough to kind of arrest the decline that we're seeing there. Right now, Bloomberg's China credit impulse is at -5% year over year. It peaked late last year at around a 10% positive growth rate. So it is not only decelerating, it's in outright negative territory. So we are 5% lower than where we were a year ago in that measure. And there's no sign of an upturn there yet. So to me, it does indicate that the slowdown that we're likely to be entering will probably persist well into the first part of 2022. And I think, you know, visibly, one way to kind of see if we're already kind of nearing that inflection point of a deceleration global growth, Citigroup does a great job of looking at economic surprises across various regions. And when you look at the U.S. and you look at Europe, we're already seeing negative economic surprises. That's something that's fairly new when we had pretty steady positive surprises for much of this year. So we're already starting to kind of see that inflection point where we now have economic data coming in below estimates, not above. So I think that's another kind of nail in the coffin that we're probably entering that deceleration phase for the global economy.
You know, the other interesting thing about China that they're facing domestically, and this is true for many parts of the world now, is the problem of inflation. And obviously, we were talking about tapering in the Fed last week on how the expectation now is that we're going to see the Fed taper back on their asset purchases likely this year, and that running through the course of 2022. And inflation is remaining higher, more persistent than originally thought. That was something that you had said was likely to take place, and we're positioned around that. So I guess at this point, what does this mean for markets?
Well, I think we're already kind of starting to see some of the early warning signs of peak growth here in the U.S. and globally. For example, you know, one of the things I showed in this week's investment meeting video was that often at times the Dow Jones Transportation Average leads peaks in the overall market measured by the S&P prior to or around inflection points in manufacturing. So we saw that in the 2014 to 2016 downturn. The Dow transports peaked in early 2015, while the S&P didn't peak until the summer. And likewise, the Dow bottomed in January 2016, just as global growth was slowing, or I'm sorry, hitting a bottom, while the S&P didn't bottom for another month later. So when we look at this year, you see that the Dow pretty much peaked the month after the U.S. ISM index peaked. And yet we're still having the S&P stock market head higher. So I think when you look at that and some other measures that I take a look at are looking at things like interest rates. You know, interest rates and the Dow all peaked this spring right around the peak in global growth, or sorry, in U.S. manufacturing. And you know, other things I take a look at are various risk relationships. For example, when I'm looking at strong balance sheets versus weak balance sheets, small cap versus large cap, junk bonds versus investment grade bonds, all of these things tend to give you a good signal in terms of risk on, risk off. And a lot of these relationships peaked earlier this year. And we haven't really seen an upturn in them yet as of right now. So I think that's just more evidence that the market's telling us that we're in that latter phase of the expansion, or at least this initial phase of the expansion, where we're still going to have positive growth, but it is going to decelerate. And during these times of deceleration, market returns become more difficult. The market becomes choppier. It's much harder to beat the market picking stocks. It's generally better to hide in the index because you really don't know which sectors are going to do well or which stocks. And so while the market becomes more volatile, corrections become more likely, this is really why I feel you kind of want to hide in the index, which to me makes a lot of sense over the next couple of months or so.
Chris, going back to what you were mentioning with Chinese stimulus and looking at their credit impulse, which has been turning over, and is one reason why it sounds like from your recent weekly investment video that you've turned a bit more cautious when you look at the leading relationship that that has on the markets. What are we seeing in terms of U.S. liquidity? Again, as I mentioned, you know, we're expected to see the Fed make some sort of official announcement on tapering back their asset purchases. I know in the past you have said that, you know, if we look at what happened in the prior cycle, tapering didn't have a really big effect on the stock market. It did have a larger effect on bonds, of course. So what are you telling investors now in terms of U.S. liquidity and impacts that this could have on the market?
Well, one thing you and I have discussed in prior weeks is that we're seeing a peak in dollar liquidity, and we're also seeing a peak in global money supply. So one way to measure that is taking the various M2 components, weighting them by the size of the various countries' economies, and then reprice them in dollars, given most of the world transacts in dollars, to kind of get a sense of what global liquidity or money supply looks like. And we've clearly seen a peak. We've saw a peak earlier this year, and it's been heading down pretty significantly. And what I did is I wanted to see what the general lead time was when global money supply peaked and when the S&P finally peaked. And what I found was during that upturn economic cycle from, you know, the early part of last decade into 2014, 2015, global money supply peaked around roughly the middle part of 2014. The S&P didn't peak for another 275 days. So it gave you a pretty good lead time before the market kind of was impacted by that loss in global liquidity. When we had the 2016 to early 2018 upcycle, we saw a peak in global money supply in early 2018, And we didn't really see a major peak in the stock market until the fall of 2018. And that was about a 174-day lead time. So when we look at the prior two downturns in global liquidity, what we see is that we have at least between 174 to 275 days before we see a meaningful pullback in the market. And when we kind of look at those timeframes and apply those to the recent peak, what that's really calling for is a potential warning sign in the fourth quarter of this year going into the first quarter of next year. So while everything I'm looking at right now doesn't really point to a major market top, the market's advancing, it's not rolling over or stalling, I do think that, in this latter phase, you really kind of want to hide out in the index. I think it'll be hard to kind of beat the benchmark. And there's, so many different cross currents where it's kind of hard to, figure out where's the best area for the market to go to. I mean, right now, even though we have a loss of liquidity through the Fed's repo facility, we've got record flows of retail money coming into equities, as well as strong record, corporate buybacks. All of those are lending supports to the market. And then also the market, I think, is taking a little bit of a bullish tone here with a possible peak in COVID cases. One of the risk factors that I'm kind of keeping an eye on that could transpire later this year is while we might see a peak in COVID cases here in the U.S. and that begins to decline, I think there's a risk and chance that we see a resurgence later this year. And I say that or think that because when you look at the efficacy of the vaccines, they really begin to wane in terms of protecting from an infection around 5 to 6 months later. So when you look at the bulk of vaccinations here in the U.S., those occurred in April. I think that was the peak in our vaccine dosage. And so when you just kind of look 5 to 6 months forward, that's kind of opening the window between now and the first, the early part of the fourth quarter. And that's when our flu season begins to ramp up. So unfortunately, I think, that could be a major risk factor in the fourth quarter where we see a resurgence in COVID cases because of declining vaccine efficacy. At the same time, we're entering our normal flu season. So that's something for me to kind of, keep a watchful eye on. While near term, we might have, the markets continuing to rally. We're seeing a lot of the areas that were beaten up come back. I think there's still some risk out there. And why, again, I mentioned, I think it's best to kind of have a neutral allocation, not a maximum risk allocation, and then also hide in the index and not try to kind of pick those winners. I think, the individual stock picking winners will be much more difficult to come by.
So, Chris, in sum, would you say that you're still bullish? You think the primary trend for the market is still higher. However, given the decline we've now seen in global money supply, the rate of global money supply, that is raising the odds of a correction over the 6 to 9 months. I mean, from today, moving forward over the next 6 to 9 months, as you mentioned, with that 175-day window and then going forward based on the prior peaks that we've seen in global money supply and when that transpired for a large correction in the market. So that's something that we should be prepared for. However, in the context of an ongoing bull market, that would be a buying opportunity to shift capital into areas that, where there is some value. And perhaps it's not until we actually see outright tightening by the Fed. Typically, we want to see at least a few rate hikes. That might be in the 20 to 23, 2024 timeframe. It would be a rough guesstimate, at which point we would start to be a little bit more fearful from a business cycle perspective that we would be looking at the next business-led recession precipitated by a tightening of the Fed. Would you agree with that outlook or any changes to that?
I would. If you think back to last year, we had a severe bear market, very sharp, dramatic drop-off, where the market fell more than 30% in short order. And with that, we had a full rate cycle. So we had the Fed cutting interest rates to zero. And we also had the central bank start up the printing presses. And if you think back to the other two major bottoms, so in 2003, we finally ended the tech bubble. And 2003 saw a massive surge in stock prices. And roughly a year later, we started to see that market slow as the market was beginning to anticipate the Fed taking the punch bowl away in the onset of the first rate hike. So 2004, the year after was a bit rough for the market, but the bull market was still intact. It was just a rough year, a lot of volatility. And when you think back a year after 2009's bottom, 2010, we saw double-digit corrections there. And that was partly with the Fed removing or ending their first quantitative easing program. So I think that's kind of what lies ahead of us in the next, 6 to 12 months is a period of heightened volatility, potential corrections in the market as we start to see a slowdown in economic growth. The Fed is moving less towards an easing posture, more towards a tightening posture, just kind of looking at its marginal changes in its actions. And then there's also a fiscal drag. When you look at the year-over-year spending by the government to stimulate the economy, that will begin to slow as well. So I think all of these things are going to lead to more volatility, more pullbacks, but ultimately not derail the bull market. So I just think, we're kind of entering that risk phase where, the easy money's been made. That's, 2009, 2003, 2020 into the early part of this year. We're now going to be into more, harder phase of the market. So I just kind of wanted to prep investors for that to, dial down the risk a bit, not be so overly leveraged or above your neutral allocation and really kind of watch your risk levels.
Well, Chris, in light of the things that we discussed today, a continuing deceleration in economic data, which we expect to persist into next year, and the peak in global money supply growth, I think what you said makes a lot of sense. And as always, if any of you listening would like to speak with us about our money management process or services, feel free to give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.